This is New America Now, dispatches from the new majority. I'm Sandeep Roy. Coming up, 30 years of the Iranian Revolution. Looking back, looking forward. The BBC launches Persian TV and Tehran is not happy. Unclench that fist. Could Obama turn a page in U.S.-Iran relations?
In Persian, if you pronounce it Obama, is loosely translated as the one who is with us.
Lessons from the revolution and the hostage crisis.
I don't think, unfortunately, in the intervening years between now and then, we have learned much at all.
30 years later, young Iranians are still trying to outrun the revolution.
They can basically outrun the Islamic police in their cars. They can just continue up a mountain where the transmission on the police car might not be able to take them over.
But first, these stories from the ethnic media.
Newsroom of New America Media, I'm Odette Keeley. This week, Iranian-American media play a critical role in creating a deeper understanding between Iran and the U.S. On the 30th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution, Iranian-American journalists see themselves as providing accurate information about Iran and its people, not only for their own community audience, but also to the general American public. Hossein Hejazi is the former program director of KIR and Radio Iran and now freelances for Iranian radio and TV in the U.S. He describes the themes that he started exploring in KIRN and continues today.
During my 7 years of service to KIRN, that was one of my biggest goals, and I was implementing that on a daily basis. And definitely there are good broadcasters here that they are trying to do that too. But we really need to be more united on this kind of endeavor, that we have to continue just tell the people the truth, bring them the latest news in Iran, and bring these ideas of Iranian inside Iran and Iranian diaspora together. And this is something that is very, very important at this point of time, because this situation between United States and Iran has been going on for almost 30 years. We are getting close to 30 years and should be stopped.
Hossein, how do you see Iranian media as trying to provide more information about Iran, its people, the government, to the community here in America, as well as to the American general public?
My answer to this question will be very disappointing for you, because this is my own opinion, that media has not played a responsible role on brightening the people, on bringing the latest information to the people, and also the unfortunate situation that there are some differences between the different group of Iranians, in especially biggest population of Iranian here in Los Angeles and suburb, the differences of the ideas and differences of their political opinion makes it more and more difficult for the people to decide and lean toward one side or another. Anytime that inside Iran something probably positive happens, like uprising of the women, uprising of the students, their challenges to the government, the media here, and mostly these satellite stations, are trying to take advantage and try to exaggerate about the incident in Iran, or call the people to go and help them. And this causes some reaction of the authorities in Iran, and they suffocate any kind of movement.
Hossein, what do you think is the most important thing Iranian Americans need to understand about the 30th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution in the context of their current lives?
Well, right now there are dialogues between the people and the media about the main reason for the revolution, which is an old story, and I don't know how important is it at this point of time. The different medias are trying very hard to talk to the people who have been involved on the revolution, and some of them think that this was not a real revolution. It was a coup d'etat. It was a conspiracy. And the others say, no, it has been a revolution. And this is one area of the conversation between the people here and the media here, what these medias are engaged in. As far as the biggest problem between the United States and Iran is one of the very, very complicated and big puzzle that exists about this fact that does regime of Iran come to sense through some dialogue or diplomacy to put away, to put aside the activities that has started on nuclear sciences and nuclear energy, and some rumors that they are trying to get a hold to an atomic bomb, or other means like sanction and other things are required so that Iran comply with the rules that the international community is expecting from it.
Hossein Hejazi, freelance journalist for Iranian American Media. He was the former program director for KIR and Radio Iran in Los Angeles, where he used to host a weekly talk show. Amir Shajare, founder of Pars TV in Southern California, immigrated from Tehran, Iran, to the U.S. after the revolution. He explains how their programs provide a unique point of view about Iran.
The reason we start this Pars TV in the United States was because of the Iranian government. They cannot get any true information from the Iranian broadcasting or newspaper. That's why we established the Pars TV from the United States. We can deliver the true signal and the news the people need. They understand truly. Then we try to do that. And 11 years now, we start Pars TV all over the world, United States and Europe and Iran. That we have our source in Iran is very hard because they control all the phone line, email and everything.
But you get a perspective from your audience in Iran with a phone-in show.
We are hearing the people because we have open line. The people can call us when we have a live show. They be able to also give their opinion to us, especially young generation in Iran. They have a very good contact with us by email and also by the live, program when we have.
There is now a very charged climate or relationship between the U.S. and Iran. Do you see some of your news programs and perspectives in Pars TV trying to mitigate that saber-rattling that's going on between the two countries?
Yes. We have two or three programs very popular in Iran. Our news first and our political discussion we have every day, 1.5 hour live.
How do you think Iranian Americans are looking at the anniversary of the revolution in the context of their current lives right now in America?
Part of the Iranian American people living in the United States is happy with the United States because they are thinking always the United States behalf of the Iranian people. Some of them, they thinking when they start the Iranian Revolution in the 1979 in Iran. And they're thinking that that time the Carter was in charge of the United States, that he was the president. And the people thinking that maybe the United States that time helped to Khomeini's regime to establish him in Iran. And that is the one of the most important, someone believe that, someone don't believe that. Now we are looking, to United States government to understand exactly after 30 years what happened in Iranian people and what caused that government in the world, not just for Iranian people. Everybody knows Iranian government caused many problems for the world. They support the terrorists. They are trying to, you know, establish nuclear weapon in Iran just to start to, you know, treat the all the country. The United States has to help Iranian people. They are trying to overthrow that government.
Amir Shajare, founder of Pars TV, based in the Los Angeles area. It's the first independent TV station for the Persian community in the U.S. and broadcasts internationally 24/7. For more stories about the ethnic media, check out our website, newamericamedia.org. I'm Odette Keeley.
On February 1, 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Tehran from exile and changed history. This is a special show marking 30 years of the Iranian Revolution.
سلام به تلویزیون فارسی خوش اومدید. تلویزیون تازه‌ای از مجموعه بی بی سی. من فرناز قاضی‌زاده هستم، مجری خبرهای تلویزیون فارسی بی بی سی.
That is the sound of the just launched Persian language television from BBC. BBC Persian TV has not exactly been welcomed with open arms by the Iranian government, but it's going to be on 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, broadcast from the BBC studios in London. And it follows on the heels of the launch of BBC Arabic last year. Seema Alinejad is the host of BBC Persian TV, and she joins me from London to explain what you can see on it. Thank you for joining us, Seema.
Thank you.
Seema, Nigel Chapman, who's the director of BBC World Service, he said this BBC Persian TV is part of having the right services and the right media for each part of the world. Why is BBC Persian TV the right services for Iran right now? Is it a 30th anniversary present?
Well, because probably as you know, the Persian TV channels are either inside Iran and they're all state controlled, or outside in LA, and they are not. I mean, we have one VOA, and the others are just like a phono more than a proper Persian TV. What we are doing is offering a balanced, impartial, and fair news and credible, reliable news to Persian speakers. Well, this might sound a little bit of cliche, and this is part of BBC values, which are sort of we observe. But this is what we're really doing, and this combined with the highest standard TV production, BBC TV production, actually helps us to offer something which is unique in Persian media.
But Seema, the BBC Persian TV is financed actually by the British Foreign Office. Won't that affect its credibility?
Actually, probably you know that BBC World Service, which used to be radio for about 80 years, and we have the Persian radio for the past 70 years, and also then the BBC Arabic, all of them, the television, all of that is financed by the Foreign Office. But that doesn't mean that they can control us or they can say anything that, you know, sort of dictate anything to us. The only thing they do is that they just help the financing. And I think this is part of the Foreign Office sort of policy to promote their own image sort of outside Britain rather than anything else, or rather than dictating us what we need to say in our broadcasting.
But the Iranian government has made its displeasure clear. I mean, they've said there won't be correspondence from Iran, and it's told the BBC World Service in Tehran that it'll be watching it to see if it tries to contribute to the programming on Persian TV. Isn't that going to hamstring you in your ability to interact with audience members in Iran?
That's true, actually. That's one of the biggest difficulties we've got, that we can't have any correspondence there yet, and we are still waiting and hoping that the Iranian government let us to have a presence there. Nigel Chapman has been to Iran a while ago, and they have said we have to look into it. But we have, as you said, a BBC English service in Tehran, and obviously we don't want to jeopardize what they are doing. But of course, there are pictures coming from Iran. We are not going to have to sneak sort of inside Iran doing anything illegal. We are just using agencies' pictures and make our own packages here in London, which I know it's not as good as it could be. when we have a president, somebody in Iran. But we are doing our best to do it as real as possible and to prove to the government that we are harmless. We are doing sort of journalistically in a proper way. And we are waiting to see what they say probably in the next few months.
Has the government tried to jam the channel? I know it tries to block BBC Persian on the internet.
They have blocked the filtered DOS, but it's not filtered. I'll come back to the TV later. But about the site, in government offices, in some universities, people can have access to us. But for sort of the general population, it is blocked. But as for the channel, it hasn't been jammed. No, we haven't heard anything yet.
Last year, BBC launched BBC Arabic, but when the Gaza attacks happened, it seemed that Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya became the sort of go-to stations for news about that part of the world. What do you hope BBC Persian can do that's not being done by stations that are based in that part of the world and not London?
We hope that to have correspondents in sort of main areas. Now we have TV correspondents in Beirut, in Jerusalem, in Kabul, in Islamabad, Turkey, Istanbul, in Washington. And we try to be in places as much as possible. We have covered Gaza conflict, the latest one, every day in our news bulletins. And we try so hard to be there and then to be present there and to sort of reflect the stories as good as we can.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Seema Ali Najad is the host of BBC Persian TV. I reached her in London. This is New America Now. I'm Sandeep Roy. 30 years after a revolution, could it be time for a new beginning for both America and Iran? Much was made of Barack Obama's campaign rhetoric about talking to Iran, and President Ahmadinejad responded this week to Barack Obama's comments on Al Arabiya television. Afshin Mulavi is a fellow at the New America Foundation and joined us to talk about where U.S. and Iranian relations stand 30 years after the revolution. And he's the author of Persian Pilgrimages, Journeys Across Iran. Afshin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
How would you react to President Obama's overture and President Ahmadinejad's response to it this week?
Well, I think it's very interesting because we have a unique moment. We have a president of the United States who has campaigned on a pledge to seek to engage Iran and other U.S. adversaries, and he reiterated that recently. We have a Secretary of State who is following those orders of engaging Iran. We have a chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in John Kerry, who has long called for engaging Iran, and we have a vice president who has long called for engaging Iran and has actively taken part off-the-record discussions with Iranian academics and others. So this is a unique opportunity. And yet, on the other hand, President Ahmadinejad in Iran did not respond particularly warmly to this notion of U.S.-Iran engagement. And when you look at the history of U.S.-Iran non-relations over the past 30 years, often there has been one side that has been more ready than the other. And I fear that the current overture will not be taken as seriously as I think it should be taken in Tehran, and we may continue this delicate but unconsummated diplomatic dance.
But why is the dance going to be unconsummated? President Ahmadinejad did congratulate Barack Obama when he won in November. Why is he clenching his fists, as it were, right now? Is it because he has elections coming up?
You know, there are elections in Iran in June of 2009, but I think it goes deeper than that. When you look at the fundamental principles of Iran's 1979 revolution, which is commonly known as the Islamic Revolution, there are basically three pillars that have remained as part of that revolutionary ethos. One of those pillars is a support for the Palestinian cause. The other pillar, frankly, is the hijab, the veiling of women, which Ayatollah Khomeini at the time thought was such a vital aspect of the revolution. And the third pillar is this notion of anti-Americanism that is so much a part of the revolutionary ethos. So it will require a great deal for those within Iran, particularly the old guard establishment. It is important to note that Iran is not a monolithic political entity. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is not the only political figure that speaks for Iran. In fact, he's not even the most powerful figure in Iran. The most powerful figure is the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. But there are competing factions. There is a relatively vibrant debate on many issues, including the issue of U.S.-Iran relations. I just personally fear that there are spoilers in Tehran who don't want this to happen, just as there are spoilers in Washington who don't want this to happen. So if it is going to happen, both in Tehran and in Washington, we're going to have to see tremendous political will for there to be a breakthrough, because they're going to have to muddle through the din and noise that is going to be made by many of the spoilers.
But do you see a lack of that political will in Iran's leadership right now? Because at some level, you could say Iran could be negotiating from a position of strength. Barack Obama says he's ready for unconditional talks. Iran, after the war in Iraq, is definitely much stronger in the region. People even pointed to what happened in Gaza recently as a way of showing that Iran is the one that came out victors.
Yes, no, I think you're right, Sandeep. Iran is, its geopolitical position has been strengthened, not only by the Iraq war, but by the Afghanistan war, where the question might be asked who won the two post-9/11 wars, and the answer might be Iran. So they certainly do have a leverage in the situation right now. But once again, the debate about engagement with the United States has not been won in Tehran just yet. And I think what we're going to see is groups are going to take sides. There's going to be factional disputes. There's going to be newspaper columns about the issue. There's going to be intellectual debates. So what I'm trying to say is that I think it is the right time now for the United States and Iran to seek to bury the hatchet.
So, Afshin Molavi, should the United States, after having made this offer, just sit back and let the factions in Iran sort out their internal debate about whether it's the right time for them to engage with America?
Yeah, I think, you know, to some extent, the ball is moving in the Iranian court. However, Iran will argue that American officials are still pointing out that Iran must do X, Y, and Z, and then we will engage with Iran. And one of those issues is that Iran must stop uranium enrichment.
Well, President Ahmadinejad issued his own set of three conditions, you know, apologize for the coup that toppled Mossadegh, apologize for the Iraq war being under false pretext,
yes,
and the support for Israel.
What I think to really put the ball in Iran's court, one would argue that America could say, okay, we are ready to discuss all issues on the table with Iran without any preconditions. That really puts Ahmadinejad on the defensive. It puts other Iranian officials on the defensive. Then what we would see is the debate that you just discussed. Then the debate would begin in Iran, and it almost becomes an offer that's too difficult to say no to. The time is right, I believe, and I think it needs to be done very carefully, and I'm not sure the decision has been entirely made in Iran. You have, Sandeep, a supreme leader at the very top of the system in Iran, in Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is a notoriously indecisive man. He often lets the factions play themselves out in Iran. He often tests the political winds before making key decisions. And even among political elites in Iran, Iran is not a dictatorship, but in Iran you have these competing factions, and you have the man at the top, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who is indecisive. And so this is, I think, going to be the problem that we are facing. But I think what President Obama has done is the right thing, and I think he has dramatically changed the discourse And I think it will be much more difficult to demonize President Obama, a man with a middle name Hussein, than it was to demonize President Bush. And the one last thing, Sandeep, I think of note, is that during the presidential campaign in America, there was a popular saying in Iran among many ordinary Iranians. They would use the phrase for Obama, his name in Persian, if you pronounce it Obama, is loosely translated as the one who is with us. And so there are many who are saying that Obama, this man, is with us. So there is a certain amount of goodwill among ordinary Iranians for President Obama.
And will the bigger challenge, though, be for the United States to bring its allies in the region, whether it's Israel or the ones you mentioned, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, on board? Because many of them are very nervous about any rapprochement between U.S. and Iran.
I think that's absolutely right. You nailed an important point. It is still unclear how many of America's Persian Gulf Arab allies feel about this issue, because they rarely speak about it publicly. But privately, American officials will say that the idea of a U.S.-Iran engagement does make them nervous, and they want to make sure that they are not left out. So I think it is important to bring them along. And it is important, you know, Russia is going to be an important player in all of this as well. So this idea of multilateralism that President Obama has spoken about will fit very well when it comes to any sort of rapprochement or engagement with Iran.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Afshin Molavi is a fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of Persian Pilgrimages, Journeys Across Iran. You're listening to New America Now, dispatches from the New Majority on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Sandeep Roy. For more stories, visit us on the web at newamericamedia.org. The shadow of the hostage crisis hangs over U.S.-Iranian relations to this day. The images on television of the American hostages in Tehran brought the Iranian Revolution into American living rooms and doomed the Carter presidency. David Harris has written about those tumultuous 444 days in The Crisis, The President, the Prophet, and the Shah, 1979 and the Coming of Militant Islam. He spoke to New America Now on the 25th anniversary of the hostage crisis. David Harris, you were the first American journalist to inspect the former embassy since the hostages were released in 81?
That's what I was told by my hosts, the Revolutionary Guard, who control the embassy now.
So what was that like? And well, how did you end up there anyway?
Well, you know, I had spent almost 9 months trying to get into Iran to try and interview specifically the veterans of the takeover of the American embassy, and then finally succeeded. And I went by with my guide the day before the anniversary just went in and introduced myself, and they went for it and said, "Oh, well, welcome," and took me through the Chancery Building, which is what you think of as the embassy. It was the nerve center of the 26-acre embassy compound, and showed me through it, and as well as several of them talked with me at length on that day.
So what's there now?
The shell of a building. There's a number of outbuildings that are part of a 26-acre compound. The outbuildings have been used by the Revolutionary Guard Corps for a recruiting depot. The Chancery Building, which is the headquarters building of the embassy, is all of its rugs and wall coverings have been stripped out. It's just a concrete shell now. And it's opened once a year to the public as a kind of anniversary, on the anniversary, as a kind of museum about American imperialism, as they describe it.
And what do they exhibit?
They've got some pictures with some captions. It wouldn't pass muster as a San Francisco museum, I can tell you that.
But do people actually go there?
Oh, yeah. Less and less. It's been, you know, in the first decade after the takeover, crowds of a million would come into the streets to celebrate the anniversary. Now, you know, maybe 5,000 people were out there on the anniversary that I was there. They seem to be mostly students who get out of school for the rest of the day if they come to the anniversary ceremonies. And while they were busily chanting at the top of their voices, "Death to America," I was circulating in the crowd, an obvious American. I don't pass easily for an Iranian, with my little press pass around my neck. And the people were very friendly to me, trying their English out on me, and so that none of that Marqbar Amrika, as the chant goes, applied to me in a personal sense.
How were you able to get access to the Iranian side of the stories, like the interviews with the then students, political leaders? I'm assuming there's no sort of Freedom of Information Act request you can file, or is there?
There were Freedom of Information Act requests, but filed on the American side.
Right.
On the Iranian side, I had to first convince the Ministry of Islamic Guidance that I ought to be admitted into the country and given a press visa. Then I had to locate a guide there who could help me find these people that I wanted to find. And I was able to find them and talk relatively freely with them. There were no monitors on my conversations. Some people didn't talk to me because they were afraid of talking to me. This is a very highly charged subject still in Iran. But for the most part, people were cooperative and wanted very badly to tell their stories. I also collected the Iranian stories in Paris. There's a big exile community of Iranians in Paris, including the former first president of the Islamic Republic, Abul Hassan Banisadr. And so I interviewed a number of Iranians there as well.
But the hostage takers, who call themselves the Muslim students following the line of Islam, during the takeover, they were often at odds with their own civilian government, not to mention with the Americans, and they wouldn't listen to anyone except an order that came down directly from the Ayatollah Khomeini. Yet now, some of them have ended up being jailed by the same religious leaders in the current government. Did people talk to you about that?
Certainly. When I interviewed these people, I could see that this once solid group of students had spread out in a number of directions and now included everything from the far-right bastions of the Revolutionary Guard to the leftist reformers that were part of the Hatami movement that took over the presidency and the parliament and is now in its last leg. But certainly, some of them are struck by the irony that this should come to pass, that ultimately they who set out to liberate their country would end up facing something far different than liberation. But that was always an issue throughout all of it. You know, for their part, during the actual crisis when it happened, they were a key element in destroying the opposition that was worried about Khomeini's lust for power and what would happen if the political system was completely dominated by the religion. And people like Abul Hassan Banisadr, the first president, or Sadegh Hoxhpadeh, who was the foreign minister during part of this, both worried and eventually, though they themselves were key allies of Khomeini, eventually turned against Khomeini because of exactly this issue, that there was no guarantee of human rights. And certainly some of those students now feel the pinch.
How are the hostage takers viewed in Iran nowadays? Are people proud of that? Are they embarrassed by it?
Well, they are abstract heroes, not nearly as intensely as they once were. I mean, part of what happened at the embassy when it was seized was that the students had no intention of staying there for 444 days. They thought they'd have maybe 72 hours in which to wage a protest against the Americans, and then they would be evicted. But what happened was, as soon as they did this, there was an enormous outpouring from the rest of Iran. This touched a sensitive chord for the Iranians, and people began making pilgrimages to Tehran. The streets outside of the embassy filled up with huge crowds. Suddenly, they were the epicenter of politics in Iran. At that time, you have to remember, politics in Iran was totally in disorder. The government of the Shah had been overthrown 9 months earlier. They had been able to establish a provisional government. They hadn't written a new constitution. They hadn't set up a permanent government arrangement. Justice was still being meted out on the street corners. There were factions against factions against factions against factions. And suddenly this group of students united everybody and became the defining factor in Iranian politics, which is a principal reason for it lasting 444 days.
Do you feel the Americans learned lessons about who to support and how long to support? One of the critical points you say in your book, The Crisis, was Jimmy Carter's state visit to Tehran, even as popular opposition to the Shah was everywhere and rising.
I don't think, unfortunately, in the intervening 25 years between now and then, we have learned much at all. I think rather we tend to take such intense experiences and try and put them as far behind us as we can. Therefore, we never learned the lessons from them. And one of those lessons was just how what seemed to be casual, unimportant acts to us were incredibly important acts. And the state dinner in Tehran that you mentioned in connection to Carter was the key one for Carter. Up until Carter's visit to Tehran for New Year's of 1977-78, he was looked upon as a hopeful part of the process by most Iranians who had some sense of him, because his policy of human rights, if he would just enforce it against the Shah, would potentially help them make the changes that they wanted in Iran. Instead, Carter got to Tehran. He was just there for a 24-hour visit, goes to a state dinner, and proceeds to talk about the Shah in terms that the Shah later described as the nicest thing any state leader had ever said about him ever. For Carter, a lot of it was just kind of Southern politician hyperbole. But when it got out on the streets, what he had said about the Shah, from that point on, Carter and the Shah were seen as two of the same. And that bitterness carried.
When you talk to the Iranians, do you get any sense of how personally they really were bitter about Carter, in as much as when the hostages were finally released, it seems clear from the book that they waited till Carter was actually going to be physically out of office so it wouldn't happen under his watch?
It's the classic illustration of just exactly how much they did hate Jimmy Carter and how much that statement he made at that state dinner played against him. They could not see Carter outside of the context of being the handmaiden of the Shah and hated him as a consequence, even to this day.
But they got Reagan instead.
Yeah, well, here we see the ignorance of the Iranian side, with no real feeling for who the Americans were or what political process they were messing with. They went out and essentially behaved in ways that guaranteed the Americans would turn far more belligerent, which is exactly what happened with the election of the Reagan administration.
But what about on the intelligence side? What lessons do you think the U.S. learned, took away from the hostage crisis? You write in the book that the American embassy in Tehran had the reputation for gathering more intelligence than anyone else, but having little idea how to interpret it. And now, some 25 years later, we are again talking about massive CIA intelligence failures.
Well, and it's of the same kind. I mean, I think there's two aspects to it. The first is simply the generalized ignorance of our culture. We don't even remember our own history, much less learn other people's histories or have an appreciation for the culture that we're dealing with. And certainly that's one of the reasons that we could collect all this intelligence and not make any sense out of it, is we simply didn't have a feel for the culture. The other failure of intelligence was a specifically political one, in which when we cut our original deal with the Shah and installed him in power, and as our first act of foreign aid to the Shah, helped him construct his secret police organization, SAVAK, which went on to torture hundreds of thousands of Iranians before it was done, part of the deal we made with the Shah was that we would not collect our own intelligence inside of Iran. If we wanted intelligence about Iran, we would collect it through SAVAK. So we never had independent lines of communication. When Khomeini's forces were still in exile and sent Hotzpadeh to the United States begging to make some kind of contact so that there could be a deal cut and to make a peaceful transition in Iran, we turned our backs on them. We refused to do so. Even when the American ambassador in the last days of the Shah recommended wholeheartedly that the United States should start independent negotiations with Khomeini's people in Paris, Carter vetoed that as an option because he felt it would undercut the Shah even more than he already was. And as a consequence, we had nobody to talk to. When we needed to know something, we didn't have it. And then when the embassy went down, all of our intelligence went down, including the files, so that the Iranians who captured the embassy could go through all the cable traffic and find out just what the Americans were up to. But even though there was plenty of warning for months, there was not any emergency plan of what to do in the case of this circumstance. You know, it was just a total failure of which at its base was one of projection. You know, we just kept assuming because we wanted the Shah and the Shah was our guy and he was a good guy that he was going to stay there, even against all evidence.
Meanwhile, in Iran, during the fall of the Shah, Marxists and religious fundamentalists made common cause against the Shah during the resolution, and the hope was for sort of an Islamic republic. That's what Bani Sadr and people wanted. What effect did the hostage crisis have on what final shape that Islamic Republic took?
It had enormous impact on the not so much the final shape of what the Republic took, but who would fill the post that really gave the Republic its definition. And the hostage crisis was used as a way of keeping the mass of the population in a kind of constant frenzy of anti-Americanism, which was always provided leverage for the far-right mullahs faction, which they used successfully against the people to their left and basically went through their original coalition, destroying one party after another party after another party. And the hostage crisis was key to that and key to them being able to exercise the ultimate kind of political control that they did.
Your book is, in fact, like part of the title is the 1979 and the coming of militant Islam. So how do you draw the line that connects what happened in Tehran in 1979 to the militant Islam everybody's talking about today?
Well, I think the line connects because this is the first outbreak of that communal antagonism, if you will, of Islam versus America. But heretofore, before the crisis, before all these events in Iran, the notion that America was locked in a struggle between itself and Islam was not widespread, to say the least. It was hardly even mentioned. So here we first get the impact of that, and I think that impact then leads straight through a whole other series of events until you finally get to 9/11.
Even though this was Shiite and most of the violence that we're talking about, the militants are Sunni, it sort of transcends that?
Yeah, I think it's that in fact, if you go through the history of Islam versus the United States, that there are Sunni parts of it, there are Shiite parts of it. They tend to go back and forth and back and forth. And although the Sunnis and Shiites don't get along with each other, they don't talk about the war between Sunnis in the United States, or they don't talk about the war between Shiites in the United States. They talk about the war between Islam and the United States. So they include each other in that process.
Thank you. David Harris is the author of The Crisis, The President, the Prophet, and the Shah, 1979, and the Coming of Militant Islam. This is New America Now. I'm Sandeep Roy. Iran might be one of the world's ancient civilizations, but after the revolution and the Iran-Iraq war, it's also one of the world's youngest countries. Around 60% of its population is under 30. As Western interest in Tehran's role in the world grows, whether it's worrying about nuclear weapons or arming Hezbollah, what are the young people of Iran worrying about? Roxanne Barzi received the first Fulbright grant for research in Iran since the 1979 revolution. She's now written a book about youth, media, and martyrdom in post-revolution Iran called Warring Souls. Roxanne Barzi, welcome to Upfront.
Thank you for having me.
The focus that we have on what are young people in Iran thinking, doing, I was wondering, is that echoed in Iran itself? Is it obsessed with its youth?
I think that people became more obsessed with the youth as they started coming of age and certain issues, problems became clear. For example, the lack of sex education over the past 20 years and the increase of abortions and the increase of premarital sex and things like that and the increase of HIV. As we saw more suicides, more HIV, more abortions, there became more of an obsession, at least from the government, with how to deal with youth culture.
And how is the government dealing with it? In your book, Warring Souls, you talk about a film called Hemlock Shukaran, which was a big box office hit, apparently.
Yeah, it's interesting. They've given a little bit more leeway to the film industry to make films that show some of the repercussions of things like premarital sex without condoms and things like that. I think one of the things that they realized is that Iranian youth were watching a lot of satellite television, a lot of bootleg videos. And the way it is in Hollywood is you have a sex scene and no one's showing anyone putting on a condom or doing any of that kind of stuff beforehand because it's just not romantic. Because we assume in our culture, within the context of what these films are watched, that most of the children in the U.S. go to sexual education at a certain point. So I think that the government started responding to the issue by, for the first time recently, instilling sexual education classes in high school instead of waiting until people apply for a marriage license, which is when it was done before.
So is sex ed in a high school in Iran different from sex ed that you might see here?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Even for the marriage license, it's quite different. It's very toned down. It's a lot about contraception. Most of it is actually about contraception and the pill.
Interesting. Well, I remember...
less so about... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, I can understand that because even in India where family planning was a big deal, I remember as a kid we'd always learn about things called the copper tea on television, but had no idea what it meant.
Right. Sort of that elusive. Yeah, that's the type of thing that we're getting now. But it's, I guess it's much better than what was happening before, which was absolute silence. And people now also have a lot more access to the web. And people are blogging about different things that concern them, especially youth. So that gives them a little bit more access as well to education if they have language, if they have English.
So do these things, even if they're not being talked about, are these the big things that concern youth? Sex, drugs, suicide, things like that?
Well, it's a thing that is affecting them, but it's not so much the things that they talk about. The things that they're really concerned about themselves are things like getting into university, the entrance exam, the concours, is extremely difficult to pass. And so a lot of youth are sort of what they call stuck behind the concours where they can't get past the entrance exam. And so they have to wait out a year, 2 years. And then because of the way the economy is rather tanking in some ways, getting a job is quite difficult as well. The unemployment rate is incredibly high. And then people who do want to marry and consummate their relationship in marriage have a hard time finding an apartment, and they have a hard time going out on their own because it's so extremely expensive in Tehran right now.
In the book, you talk about how drug things like drug use and suicide are on the rise. What are the reasons for it, and are they different from the reasons here?
I think a lot of the reasons are not so different and yet different. I think part of it is this lack of mentorship. A lot of youth who came of age during the revolution didn't really have anyone to turn to that they felt that they could trust. There was always a lot of emphasis in secular homes, I should say, in the youth that I was looking at, whose parents didn't agree necessarily with the Islamic Republic. In those homes, they were given a certain message about how they had to be in school. And then in school, they were given a different message. So they had a very hard time going to their parents, who were very sort of strict in one way and sort of had very strong ideas about the ways that things should be done, but we're still very conservative and still, you know, back in the culture of 1969. And then not being able to go to their teachers because their teachers were ideologues in a sense. And so they were kind of stuck without any sort of mentorship. And I think that is what's really caused a lot of issues, especially with suicide and depression. And then the lack of, you know, Iranians, it's not a confessional society. So there was a real lack of therapy. There was a real lack of being able to deal with issues like drugs or depression. Now they've started 12-step programs and therapists are more readily available and not looked down upon so much.
You have a stories in here about how opposite sexes meet. And you write, you need a fit body, a fast car, and a knowledge of geography. Okay, I wanted you to explain that.
Well, a lot of times what happens is with the secular upper class, again, this is the upper class youth who can afford cars with good engines, they can basically outrun the Islamic police in their cars. So if they're about to be stopped at a roadblock or something like that, they can just continue up a mountain where the transmission on the police car might not be able to take them over. Since I wrote that, actually, recently, I think Mercedes-Benz cars that are like, you know, top of the line have replaced the old Paycon police car. So I don't know if that's happening so much anymore. So
are you responsible for this?
I hope not. I don't want to, you know, well, yeah. Let's just say I don't think so.
Well, one of the things that you do write is, even as you look at this upper class, upper middle class, secular youth or children of secular parents, you write that journalists like Christiane Amanpour and Western policymakers, they really want to show Iranian youth in a certain way, that they're westernized, they're secular, they wear baseball caps and listen to rap music, and would be just like us if it weren't for their dark clergy. And what does that fail to capture?
It fails to capture the nuances of culture, and it fails to capture the fact that most people are very respectful of their religion. And whether it's Islam or Christianity or Judaism, whatever they practice, and especially those who do practice Islam, I think that what I try to delineate in the book is that you can be secular but still practice your religion, that you can believe in having a secular state, you can believe in having a secular public space. And I think that here the media tends to want to separate that and completely erase the religious aspects of the culture.
Which sometimes leads me to think is what leads us to believe that, oh, if we only get rid of this one person, whether it's Saddam Hussein in Iraq or the identified bogeyman, that everyone will just jump on the bandwagon. And as some of our leaders say, you know, strew the path with rose petals to welcome you.
That's right. And it's unfortunately, it's missing a lot of important nuances. A lot of Iranian youth love American culture, and they would love nothing more than to have a student visa to come to this country and continue their education. But a lot of the press, a lot of the what is happening in our media is really alienating a lot of those youth and pushing them more and more toward defending their leaders.
Now, when you were researching this book, Warring Souls, were these during the Khatami years or was it after that?
It was during the Khatami years. It was really at the height and then sort of as things were going downhill. I started going back to Iran in 1991 during Rafsanjani, actually.
So do you think that the Khatami years, did they not really change anything in the end? Has everything sort of lurched back?
I wouldn't say that. I think they changed a great deal. And again, I don't. It's hard to say as an anthropologist whether it was Khatami necessarily that changed things or whether it was the coming of age of a group of youth who really weren't afraid in the ways that, say, people who saw the revolution and saw what it was like before. They had a very different mantle to carry in certain ways, and they had very different views of things. But this group, they grew up in the Islamic Republic, and they knew how to deal with it, which is a lot of what I talk about in my book. They knew how to get away with things. They knew how to participate on certain levels, remake public space, which I talk about a lot. So part of it was the coming of age of people who were trained to be able to speak back. And then the other part was the opening that Khatami allowed. And that opening, combined with this group of youth who were really quite rebellious, allowed this moment that we had in 2000 where Iranian artists were really emerging in their own right, and young filmmakers and young writers and young poets. And they were being accepted outside, and they were getting visas, and they were traveling to Berlin and Paris and London and even some to New York, and they were being exposed to these things. So there was a moment of openness, and there were reform papers. So I would say that a lot of it had to do with that moment, maybe a missed opportunity on many levels.
Your book, Warring Souls, is called About Youth, Media, and Martyrdom in Post-Revolution Iran. And I wanted to ask you why you chose to focus on martyrdom and how important is it as a concept in Iran? And what do we here in the West need to understand about it?
Well, it's interesting. Martyrdom is very different in different contexts. For example, the suicide bombing and things like that that have happened more in the Arab world are very different from what happened in the Iran-Iraq War, which is what I studied, which was mainly, it was a conventional war, and it was two armies, two nation states that were fighting. And for the most part, it was more about going forward as a line of defense, and it was couched as a sacred defense. The reason I became really interested in the war is because when I first went back in 1991, the war had just barely ended, and there were UN peacekeepers on the ground. And I was really worried as a half-Iranian, half-American with a Michigan accent that people really wouldn't accept me, that my family would sort of look at me as a foreigner, and it would be really difficult because I didn't know Persian at the time. But what I found that really separated me from the average Iranian was the fact that I hadn't lived through this almost decade-long war. And it made me quite obsessed with the war, actually. And that's why I decided to go and interview veterans and then think about martyrdom and what that meant.
And what did you find?
I found it's interesting. I found that when I was studying, I had a professor that said, you know, martyrdom actually started out through some of the communist stuff that was happening in Iran in the 1950s through the Tudeh Party. And so it wasn't something that was completely alien to modern Iran. Now, it's something that goes all the way back to Karbala. So it's something that's kind of ingrained in Shi'i culture in certain ways, this martyrdom of Hussein. And this is exactly what Khomeini picked up on and what he used to get people to go and fight the war. Because quite frankly, when Iran and Iraq started the war, Iran was in no position militarily, and especially because the government had just shifted and a lot of the military had fled the country, they were in no position to send people out there who really knew what they were doing. So it was much easier actually to just send people barehanded to go out and defend the country. And the whole paradigm of Karbala and martyrdom was a very useful way of doing that.
Having sort of observed this, what do you think are the biggest fault lines in Iranian society now?
All right. I think, honestly, one of the problems is that media came in so quickly in some ways. There were always satellite dishes throughout, and there were always videotapes. You know, the way that the revolution started, it started with imported cassette tapes of Khomeini's sermons. So technology was always something that has been part of the legacy of the revolution and the culture that came after it. So people always had access. But I think what's interesting is as our culture here in the West has become much more and more materialistic, so has the culture in Iran, and at a much faster speed. And in some ways, I think a major fault line is this lack of respect, actually, for human daily existence to the point of this influx of needing material goods. And one example is Japan. Among youth in Japan, there was that big craze with Louis Vuitton bags and the things that high school students would do that I won't get into to get a Louis Vuitton bag. And I think that culture is coming a little bit late to Iran, but in a very intense way. And that's something that I'm a little bit concerned about, is this move away from things that are more fulfilling on a spiritual level, like art or literature and things like that, and a more sort of consumer-oriented quick fill-up for people who are depressed and who feel that they're lacking, and that it's probably much more complicated than can be answered here, but that's the idea.
Was one of the things you write about in this book, Warring Souls, is about the volcanic energy seething and ready to erupt beneath
exactly.
The thick skin of Tehran youth. But given what you said, could it be that this appetite for material good, the Louis Vuitton bags and things like that, in some ways will mean that maybe there cannot be another revolution in Iran, because revolution needs a different kind of idealism.
Precisely, which is why it's a little bit frustrating, too, when you have a lot of journalists that go in and want to peg some sort of incident that happens. For example, students are writing about tuition increases and say that they've become revolutionary in certain ways. I don't think that that's what's happening. And I think that they've lived through the disappointment of their parents and what their parents went through through the revolution. So I think that they don't see that as a way necessarily out of their misery in certain ways.
Thank you. Roxanne Varzi is Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Irvine, and author of Warring Souls, Youth, Media, and Martyrdom in Post-Revolutionary Iran. Thanks for listening to New America Now, dispatches from the new majority, interethnic, international, and intergenerational news for the new America. New America Now is also available as a podcast. Go to newamericamedia.org and click on New America Now. Our engineer and technical producer is Eric Wayne. Mary Ambrose directs the show. We had production assistance this week from Max Klein. New America Now is produced at the KALW Studios in San Francisco by New America Media. Thanks for joining us. I'm Sandeep Roy.